talks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is John Bradshaw, anthropozoologist and author of the New York Times bestseller Dog Sense. He's also foundation director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol, anthrozoology being the study of interaction between living things, often humans and animals. Bradshaw has written a new book, Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. We'll discuss that book with him presently. Later in today's show, we'll also have a brief chat with Patricia Massari, one of the coordinators of the Tampa Bay Walk for Farm Animals, farm sanctuary event taking place November 2nd at Spa Beach Park in St. Petersburg. We'll get to all this in a moment. First, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge a cat our family lost recently. In fact, a week ago today, he was Smokey McGar Page, a kind and gentle cat who was my mother-in-law's faithful companion for 19 years. He was a handsome devil, intrepid traveler, very cool guy. We'll all miss him. Rest in peace, Smokey. All right, let's get to our discussion with John with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome John Bradshaw back to Talking Animals. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals, and congratulations on yet another book that... And addressing some of our most familiar animals is fascinating and by turns kind of revelatory and maybe even provocative here and there. So, for instance, any cat lover and or anyone paying much attention to cats knows that purring isn't strictly an expression of a cat being content, but maybe you could talk about the array of things a cat really could be communicating while purring, which goes beyond, I think, the what most of us would have understood about cats, even if we knew it wasn't always strictly that they're content at that moment.
Yeah, purring is essentially just a signal the cat's giving to you, which means something like stay calm, stay close, and pay attention to me. And so a lot of the time, it does mean that the cat's contented. And of course, if you do the thing that the purr is asking you to do, then it will become even more contented. But there are some cats which have a kind of different purr, a more urgent type of purr. It is distinctive in terms of its sound, but it is definitely still a purr. And it's one they use when they are asking for food. So you get the cat going around the kitchen, making this very loud and rather, some people find it rather unpleasantly loud purr, which means give me food.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another kind, which maybe only veterinarians and veterinary nurses and so on, people who are into rescuing cats will have heard, and that is when a cat is in great distress or maybe even pain after perhaps being hit by a vehicle. And they will purr in those circumstances. Well, clearly they are not contented when they're doing that. They are asking you to stay calm, pay attention to me, and see what I need. And of course, in that circumstance, it's a very different thing to the cat that's curled up on your lap in front of the TV.
Sure, and you I think kind of intimated the answer to my question in a way about talking about that's another maybe recognizing the one that really signals they're in pain. But I was wondering to what extent can someone maybe more of a layperson develop the ability to really discern the difference in the sounds of purring in a cat and what those differences mean. I mean, are they really distinctly different, or is it still just purring, but it's hard to necessarily recognize what they're saying?
I think if the cat's making the purring noise when it's in great pain, I think you kind of have other clues as to what's going on. I mean, the cat's body posture will be very tense. You may obviously be able to actually see where the cat's been hurt. So I don't think there should be too much difficulty in recognizing that one.
Yeah.
The The one that they do when they want something urgently, usually, as I was saying, they're wanting to be fed.
Mm-hmm.
There's a kind of a singing quality to it as well. And some people have likened that to a baby's cry, that there's almost a purr going on. And then underneath that, there's a sound a little bit like a crying baby. I must say, I've heard it. I can't see the analogy, but some people certainly say that that is what it reminds them of, and there's clearly something like that. It's got a kind of singing quality to it, as well as the kind of the rumbling sound that is the purr.
Well, I'm sure there must be highly sophisticated studies that delve into exactly how those sound differently and what the frequency might be, and who knows what else. But yeah, I think the key thing is that there's just a lot more to a cat's purr than a lot of cat lovers might have initially thought.
Absolutely, yeah.
So one topic that comes up towards the end of the book that conversely I sort of wanted to raise, obviously, towards the beginning of our conversation, and that's declawing. I'm sort of, I have to admit, John, kind of mildly obsessed with this horrific procedure, and partly because I think declaw is such an egregious misnomer, and I've done a bunch of shows on it over the years, and most recently tied to this excellent new documentary that you may or may not have seen called The Paw Project. But even as steeped in declaw as I am, I hadn't really, until reading your book, hadn't really pondered the element of phantom pain. Can you sort of, first of all, I guess, review for those listening who may not be as familiar with declaw, what that is, but then sort of touch on phantom pain, both in terms of the cat that's had the declaw and the way you in the book actually sort of connected to your own experience with phantom pain.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, declawing is it's kind of a little bit of a misnomer. I mean, you take if you did remove a cat's claw, it would grow back again. It's natural for that to happen. Clearly, when cats were wild animals, there would be occasions when they would lose a claw in a fight or when trying to subdue an animal that was, that they wanted to eat but was too big for them or whatever. And the claws grow back. So what has to happen in order to stop a cat from having claws permanently is not simply removal of the claw, but you have to remove the whole end of the toe. And also the claw itself and that toe are full of nerve endings. I mean, they're incredibly sensitive. They're more sensitive than our fingernails are.
Yeah.
Because, again, the cat, when it's hunting, when it's going around, it's getting a lot of information as to what's going on under its paws or in its paws from the nerves in those claws. So there's a lot of nerve endings there, and in removing the claw and the last toe bone, those have to all be severed. And so it's occurred to me that, from my own personal experience, this could be something that the cat then has to essentially deal with for many months or even years afterwards, that that phantom pains may well be part of it. I mean, I guess we're all familiar with the idea of, a vet coming out of the army with an amputated leg, then they get phantom pains, and they can be very, very distressing, and they can keep the guy up at night and all sorts of things. But at least as humans, we have the ability to look at it and go, actually, I know my leg isn't there anymore, and the pain, however real it feels, you can say it's not real. I don't have to attend to my leg. I have to deal with the pain, but I don't at least know that my leg's got a problem because I know it's not there anymore.
Yeah.
So, I had an accident many, many years ago when I was in my 20s where I lost the tip of a finger, on my ring finger, in fact, on my left hand. And it was replaced, but only kind of cosmetically. The nerve endings had all gone.
Mm.
The bone and the ends were shattered. And for many years afterwards, I used to get phantom pains from that finger. I mean, they weren't particularly bad. I'm not saying I'm in the same position as a veteran who's lost a leg or anything like that. But it just made me think, if that's happened eight times to a cat, then that's what it will be. Eight toes will have had the ends removed if you're just doing the front claws. And, of course, it's 16 if you have the back ones done too, which mm-hmm. I know not many people do. But there is every possibility. I mean, phantom pain is not a thing that comes with consciousness. It presumably happens to every animal. It's just a property of the mammalian nervous system, if you like.
Yeah.
So cats should get phantom pains the same way that humans do. It's just they don't have the language to tell you about them. So I suspect that this may be a problem. And they do certainly have very tender feet for a while after the operation, and that may be part of it. Over here in Europe, decloying is classed as a mutilation. Veterinarians are not allowed to do it. They can lose their license for doing it. So it's globally, there are some very different, almost opposing attitudes towards it.
Yeah, well, this documentary I alluded to called The Paw Project, there's a vet based in Southern California who kind of almost single-handedly has helped outlaw declaw in Santa Monica initially and then several other cities in California, and obviously is hoping to expand that across the states just because, as you say, the UK and so many other countries already that's completely against the law to conduct that procedure. So, but again, having thought a lot about declaw and again about the pain and how they can't, often they don't function well then in their litter box and they start biting more. All the other things happen which is, as you described, is really more amputation than anything like a nail clip with declaw would suggest. I just hadn't really thought before about phantom pain on top of all the other awful things that the cat experiences. So sort of a tough revelation, but an important one, certainly. So
yeah, well, I mean, I don't have any direct evidence for it, but it's
right.
Something I'm raising as a possibility.
Right, and like you say,
if humans can get it, then why not cats?
Right, and again, same kind of thing with losing that part of their limbs, because that it really is, they are losing that last knuckle, effectively, on each toe that's declawed. So it makes perfect sense. So this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, my guest is John Bradshaw, anthrozoologist and author, most recently, of Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. If you'd like to ask John a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. And sort of speaking of things, people that even are fairly steeped in a lot of these issues and just cats generally may not have thought of. I mean, one observation that you make in the book that I imagine will be jarring for some to ponder, probably generate a bit of controversy if it hasn't already, has to do with the potential long-term downside of spay-neuter. And again, I emphasize that's long-term, as you make a point of doing in the book. But can you explain sort of the thinking behind this, where this might be heading in your view?
Yeah, sure. Essentially, we're looking at 10,000 years of coexistence between man and cat. And I'm sure that the cat has changed a great deal over that time. I mean, just by comparing the domestic cats we have today with the wild ones that are still around in North Africa and in Western Asia, where they were domesticated, they're very different beasts. So the cat has changed a lot over that time, and two of the things that have changed have been they get on much better with other cats. The wild animals are pretty solitary, and while our cats don't always get on together, some of them do, and that's an advance, certainly. That's a change. And the other thing is, of course, is that they're able to form very close attachments to us. They're able to not only to learn that human beings are nice people to be around, nice things to be around, but also that they can recognize us as individuals and have a proper relationship with us, which I think some cat detractors can suggest they don't. But obviously, any cat owner will know that a cat really does know them as a person and they have a proper relationship. So and then there's another thing that we haven't really changed very much, which is their ability to hunt, because really two reasons. One is that we have encouraged them to hunt. I mean, it's been the purpose for keeping cats for much of that time. Some people still keep cats simply to keep their farmyard free of rats, that kind of thing. And also that cat nutrition is a very fine art, and it hasn't been only maybe the last 30, 40 years that most people have had the ability to feed their cats a proper diet, because their nutritional requirements are very strict, and really the nutritionists didn't realize that until 30, 40 years ago. So they haven't had time to lose that habit of hunting, and yet we've now suddenly decided that we don't like it. We don't like it when they bring in animals. The wildlife lobby don't like it. So we have an animal which I think is fitting reasonably well with our lifestyles at the moment, but as you know, the world becomes more urbanized, and we live closer together, I think we're going to expect more of our cats. What's happened at the same time is that the whole basis for the evolution of cats has turned around. And originally, you know, we were basically breeding and allowing around us cats that were good at hunting, because that's what we value them for, but also good at being with people, looking more at the pet side. And we encourage cats to do that. You know, the cats that got on well with people were the ones that that had the best lives and left the most offspring. Now suddenly we have spay neuter, which is a fantastic thing for the welfare of not only pet cats but also feral cats, that we can allow them to live in places where perhaps people might not everyone wants them to be, but at least where they're not producing lots of kittens, which then get sick and die and create all sorts of problems for the people around them too. So in principle, you know, it sounds a fantastic idea. It sounds as if it's a win-win, that the cats get to live, but they have their, and their welfare is improved at the same time. What I'm kind of pointing out is that in the book is that in the future, if we carry on doing that and we carry on taking kittens from rehoming, from the offspring of feral cats and so on, which is a great thing to do in principle, of course. But if we repeat it over and over again, we're actually driving domestication backwards, because we're neutering all the animals that are actually getting on best with us, and we're taking kittens and young cats from cats which are basically living independently. We're not there yet, except in a few places. I mean, in the UK here, there are some areas where neutering rates are well above 90%, and there are not enough kittens being born to satisfy local demand. They're obviously brought in from other areas, so there are still plenty of kittens to go around. But if that, you know, if here in the UK we get to the point where neutering is 90-something percent over the whole country, then I think there is a question to be asked about are we driving domestication very slowly backwards, and should we not actually be putting some more thought into targeting neutering and maybe developing some new cat breeds? I think that's probably one way forward, that are not developed to look pretty. Not developed for the show ring, but are they could come in any colour you want, but are developed for having the very best temperament, for the easiest cats to socialise, the ones that get on with other cats, the ones that don't hunt, and the ones that are easy to get along with their owners and with children and that sort of thing.
Right. So yeah. So it's a really interesting notion of that by at the moment doing the quote unquote right thing, that over time. Yeah, what we're doing to the cat genetic pool and behavioral pool, there's going to be a downside to that at some point down the road. And so yeah, your suggestion about breeding, like you say, is not anything related to cat shows and looking a certain way or getting fluffy just right or whatever, but sort of offsetting what may be a diminishing of exactly the kind of behaviors, personalities, et cetera, that we would want to continue to see in our cats over time.
Yes, I think long term we will soon, I think, have better tools for doing that, because it's now known that the domestic cat and the wild cat, the ancestor, there are probably only a dozen or so genes that are different between them. And once the molecular biologists have worked out exactly what those genes do and how they actually cause the domestic cat's brain to be different to the wild cat's, then I think we have the tools to identify the most domesticated cats around us, and then maybe the source for the new breed of cat, if that's what it turns out to be, from those individuals. And that would be possible, would become possible simply by combing the cats, and you can get enough DNA out of the little bits of skin attached to the hair to get a complete profile of that cat in terms of its genetics and how good it will be to socialize and that sort of thing. So I think, I think just around the corner, maybe 10 years from now, we will actually have the tools to be able to do that.
Yeah. Well, and actually in responding to that question, John, I mean, you raised a couple other things that are interesting that also come up in the book. One that you talk about, just the hunting thing and the idea that cats, of course, bring, birds or rodents into the house. Related idea that I think cat lovers sort of entertain a lot is that this may turn out to be not quite as simple as we all first thought, which is that when cats do that, they're bringing their humans, basically a gift. And it sounds like that it may not be quite really that magnanimous necessarily.
No, I think that's something which a lot of people believe. But and of course, the cat does sometimes behave as if it is. It literally drops the little dead mouse in front of you, and you kind of, it's automatic, I think, if a person did that. It hopefully wouldn't be a dead mouse. It's a present from a person, but you'd get the idea that it was a gift. But No, I think I can't see how that would have evolved. I don't think that that the cats have that in mind. I think what they're doing is simply bringing the prey home to somewhere where they think they may begin to eat it in a safe place, where they're not likely to get ambushed by another cat or whatever. And then when they get home, they remember that that mice actually, or whatever they happen to be, actually aren't that great to eat, because that is known, that virtually all of the better quality commercial cat foods available today are much tastier, as far as cats are concerned, than anything they're likely to be able to catch for themselves. And they're getting all the nutrition they need from modern cat food, so there really isn't any need for them to eat the mice. I mean, years ago, or if you go to a village in South America, maybe where the cat food isn't obtainable, then studies have been done there showing that cats do eat the prey that they're much more likely to eat the prey that they catch. But that's just because they don't have much of an alternative, either in terms of flavor or in terms of nutrition.
Yeah.
But in our modern society, we're actually they're getting a much better deal from the supermarkets than they are from their own claws. So they go. Once they get home, they realize that that's to wait for the owner to feed them.
Right, they may have temporarily forgotten. Hey, I'm going to have dinner thanks to this guy in about 2 hours, so no need to drag this in after all. But this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with John Bradshaw, author of Cat Sense: How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. And we do have a couple emails. John says, "Good morning. I always love listening. Got a new cat. Rita, 1 year fixed feral, turned backyard, lovely one, but cannot keep her claws in when I play, when I pet, when I brush. What can I do to get this little one to put the claws in when I am around?"
Yeah, that's quite a common thing. We think that the kittens get taught, they don't instinctively seem to keep their claws in when they play. And what happens is usually when they're with their mother, they'll start to play with her, and the mother will quickly tell them off and tell them to stop doing it. There are a couple of strategies. I mean, one is I always prefer to start with something which is very gentle on the cat, because cats don't respond well to kind of punishment type training. They very quickly start to dislike the person who does that. So that's something to be avoided if you possibly can. Dogs are much more tolerant of it, but cats are not. So I think the thing to do is to if the young cat is sometimes using the claws and sometimes not, is to get some little bits of food handy that the cat really likes. You have to work that out, what it is for your own cat. Cats are different. Sometimes it's a commercial treat. Sometimes you have to buy some prawns or something like that, or maybe some little bits of chicken. Have them handy, and when the cat is playing in a way that you like, or letting you groom it with the claws in, keep giving it these little treats as well, and then it'll learn that this is a good thing to do, because not only do I get the attention of my owner, but I get something nice to eat as well. And then as soon as the claws come out, all of that stops. You back off. Don't hit the cat or anything like that, because it will very quickly learn to avoid you, and that's the last thing you want. But just stop whatever it is you're doing. Hide the treats. The treats go away. The cat will very quickly learn that claws out is not as much fun as claws in, and so it'll take a few days, maybe a few weeks, but it'll gradually learn to always do is to keep the claws in all the time. If this is a really energetic cat that always has its claws out, then you might need to resort to some very gentle admonishment. And what I do is to imitate the mother cat. And remember, I was saying the mother cat will often teach the kitten to keep its not to let its claws out while it's playing. They will make a kind of what sounds like a dry spitting noise at the kitten. And I've done that with one of my cats that did play with the claws out. And you just go this sort of noise at the cat. And if it's a young cat, it will kind of remember that. It seems to know that that's a thing that it should pay attention to while the claws are out. But anything more than that, I think you'll find that you'll put the cat off playing entirely, which is probably the last thing you want.
Great. All right. Well, thanks for your question. Thanks for your answer. Let's take a call. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with John Bradshaw.
Hello.
Hi, it's you.
Yeah, my name is Tom. Interesting program. My only question is that, you know, when we allow cats to be loose, you know, these neuterum or whatever, which is one step in the right direction, they're still out in the wild killing, you know, birds and, as you mentioned before, not necessarily eating them because they get better food at home. I mean, what's the solution to that? I mean, you don't want to declaw them if they're a wild cat, but I just don't know how we can fix that because studies I've read, they one cat was documented killed 3,000 animals in the summer, or maybe I got the numbers wrong, but a substantial number of bykill from one cat. That's one thing I don't know how we can fix that because there's such ultimate, you know, terrestrial killing machine.
Okay, you know, I appreciate your question. If it's okay, I'm gonna take your call off now, just because I think you're in a weird cell zone and there's a lot of noise. But I'll have John respond to your question. Thanks for your call.
Oh, perfect.
So, John, I hopefully you got most of that at least.
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
We're talking about the cruel killing that cats do, as some people see it. I mean, of course, it's just a natural thing that cats do that we've been encouraging them to do for thousands of years. So they, you know, we it's hard to turn it on its head you know, overnight. I think there's a couple of things. I mean, the damage done to wildlife by pet cats in the United Kingdom and I think the United States as well is mostly not a problem as far as wildlife numbers are concerned. I mean, there's been some fairly extensive research done over here in the UK. So. For example, one of the birds that cats bring in a lot or kill a lot in the UK are chickadees, and especially during the winter. And despite that, and despite the large numbers that are apparently involved, I mean, there may be, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of birds involved. It sounds terrible. But the year on year, the population level of chickadees in British gardens is going up rather than down. So the cats can't be having any lasting effect. We think the reason for that is largely that most pet cats are very lazy killers. They actually only kill birds or small rodents that are kind of not too well anyway, that are unlikely to survive long enough to leave more offspring and contribute to the next year's population. And so they're what some people call surplus killers. They are actually just taking out the sick and the unwell. Unlike some other predators, which may focus a little bit more on more healthy animals, that's not to say that every cat is like that. I'm just there talking about pet cats population as a whole. I mean, there are undoubtedly cats which do kill a lot of animals. They seem to be in a minority, certainly over here, but I think if you've got one of those, you'll probably want to do something about it. There are some things we recommend over here, putting a collar with a bell on it. It's got to be a quick release collar. We don't want the cat getting hung up on a fence post or something and hurt by that. But one of the snap off collars with a bell on it will cut down the number of animals that that the cat can get to. And keeping the cat in some of the time again will kind of give the wildlife a bit of a respite. So if it's a cat that kills a lot of rodents, keep the cat in at night. If it's a cat that kills a lot of birds, try to keep it in during the day, and maybe that'll reduce things. But a lot of cats learn this when they're kittens, when they're young, so it does depend a little bit where you get your cat from. If you get it from a rehoming center, you may be picking up a cat that whose mother has had to fend for it herself to catch a lot of prey to survive. And so that cat may have already learned how to do things, how to actually hunt effectively. But they do seem to be in a minority. I think it's feral cats that seem to be the real problem as far as wildlife is concerned. I think pet cat owners shouldn't feel too guilty about it, because it really is the feral cat population that's causing the damage.
Well, so this is probably exactly the right moment then to sort of talk a little bit more about feral cats. I mean, almost any discussion people seem to have about feral cats tends to be a bit emotionally charged. I mean, but in your book, you present a pretty sizable bit of objective, very sort of science-based info about feral cats, how their colonies function and change over time, and their impact on wildlife. So views on feral cats and feeding them and doing TNR was one camp, and eradicating them was another. I mean, these are very broad, no nuanced views, of course. Where do you come down based on all the science and research that you've done related to feral cats over the years?
Well, in terms of the management side, I'm in favor of the TNR route, and I think there are two reasons for that, and I think one of them they tend to get ignored, but one of them particularly. One is essentially that feral cats are only there because there are resources provided for them. Somehow they are getting enough to eat. You know, and cats have a very demanding requirement for their diet, so they can't scavenge around, even maybe like a dog would. They really have to get high quality nutrition. So if there are feral cats there and the feral cats are breeding, then there's high quality nutrition in the neighbourhood. That you just cannot have one without the other. So if you do exterminate the cats, then what will happen is that very soon, if you don't also address the source of the nutrition, then other cats will move in. Cats reproduce very fast. As soon as there is a source of food with very few cats around it, not only will cats move in, but the female cats will have bigger litters as a result of that than they normally would, because they're so well fed. They're finding lots of food. They'll have five or six kittens when maybe they would only have two or three when the diet was a bit more of a problem. So very quickly you get the cats replacing themselves in that area. Obviously, it's a different bunch of cats. They've come in from a few miles away, but essentially problem is back. And then what do? Exterminate all over again. Whereas if you neuter and put the cats back, they seem to be able to look after themselves reasonably well. But the other side of the story, I think, is the human one. And we're not dealing with a pest animal in the simple sense of the word. We're not dealing with locusts eating a crop. We're dealing with a human issue as well. Somewhere along the line, somebody is producing that nutrition for those animals. It may be that it's just bad hygiene at a restaurant. They're using their dumpsters badly. They're not covering them, that kind of thing. But more often than not, and that's certainly here in the UK, and I think worldwide, it's people who are very fond of cats and are feeding them. And you need to engage with them. They're not usually the people who are happiest to have people kind of interfering with what they see as their right. But if you're going to solve the feral cat problem, you have to engage with those people. You have to find out what they're doing, what their motivations are, and then work with them rather than against them. If you simply exterminate the cats, those people will work twice as hard to replace them, encouraging every cat that turns up. If you do the TNR, those people will hopefully, and talk to the people who are feeding them, you can explain and hopefully get through the message as to why you've done it, why they shouldn't be putting too much food out, why they should be reporting that when new cats turn up, so that those ones can be neutered as well, because undoubtedly new cats will turn up. It's just the way they are. They migrate around. That way, I think you can get the whole situation under control much better than if you just go in and say, well, these are pest animals, as if you're a rodent exterminator getting rats out of a house or termites out of a house. That is a different problem entirely, because it involves people.
Yeah, and one thing that I think you sort of touch on with talking about the a colony near, I guess, insane asylum, as I recall. But over time, I think various cat groups and people studying colonies and stuff have found that at least over a long period of time, even though, as you say, new cats wander into the colony, that if there is effective TNR being done, that over eventually a longer period of time, that colony will shrink if not disappear. Is that consistent with kind of your findings, or?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I mean, it will shrink. Clearly, it will shrink as the resources shrink. I think ultimately your long term goal should be to try to persuade the people who are providing the food, because ultimately they are the source of the problem, if you like. They don't see themselves that way, of course. They see themselves as doing good for cats that are having a bad life otherwise.
Right.
And they have a point, of course. So, but it's getting them to appreciate what's going on, and maybe to say, well, look, you love cats. Rather than feeding cats out here, which is getting other people angry with you, why don't you give more help at the rehoming center or that kind of thing, and get the cat lovers, even if initially they're a little bit suspicious, and the rehoming and neutering charities working in harmony, and then I think you've got a you can develop a total management solution. And if there's no food available for the cats won't come back. They can't do that.
Yeah.
They don't exist. You know, they don't.
As simple as that, really. Yeah, yeah. So this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with John Bradshaw, author of Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. We're sort of in the last minute or two of that, but I'm going to try to work in maybe at least one email, one call if we can. So one emailer says, we have a cat that upon hearing conversation howls continuously. Have you seen this before? Love the book and thank you for your insightful work.
Well, thank you for appreciating the book. That's really good to hear. The howling is probably, I mean, I'd have to hear it, I guess, to be able to give you a definite answer, but cats are not known for being attention-seeking. That, you know, dogs are very attention-seeking. They want to get your attention all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They'll do all kinds of things to do that. Some of them are desirable. Some of them are less desirable. But cats, especially cats that are very attached to people, and cats do vary in that, but there are many cats that are very attached, will develop little routines to get their attention. I was talking to somebody else on another radio station a little while ago who said that their cat used to ambush them. They used to go. It used to climb up to the top of their freezer and then jump on their head as they were going by when they were cooking or something.
Wow!
And as a way just of getting the person's attention. Of course, when the cat does that, I mean, some people will object. But if you don't, if you go, oh wow, well, that was clever, the cat will go, that's how to get his attention. I'll do that again.
Wow.
And so maybe the howling is a just they all develop only in their own individual ways. There's no standard way that cats have for doing it.
Right.
So that's probably it.
So I guess if you're responding to the howling in any way, then by the same token as the guy dive bombing from the refrigerator, then you're sort of sending a message, hey, keep howling because it's working.
Yeah. That's exactly it. If you don't like the cat howling, then try and, you know, ignore it. And work on a different thing. But why not? You know, it doesn't sound too bad.
Okay. All right. Let's try to quickly take one last call. Hi, you're on the air with John Bradshaw on Talking Animals. We have just maybe about 30 seconds for a quick question if you have one.
I just have a comment about the cats being danger outside.
Mm-hmm.
I walked my cat on a leash, and he was about 3 months old when I got him, and he took right to it. And it worked well for me. And I think if we tried, we could get more cats on a leash. Right now it's pretty rare to see it, but it could be done. I'd like to hear his thoughts on it, and I will hang up and listen to his reply.
Okay, thank you so much for your question. Okay,
yeah,
John?
I think cats on leashes are fine. I mean, they do take a little bit of training to accept the harness. Some cats never really get comfortable with them, but if they're comfortable and you can, I think, walk the cat regularly in the same place because they want to sniff just the same way as dogs do. They want to sniff their regular places. But it's a good alternative to letting the cat out and loose, especially if you know there's traffic or anything nearby. If more people could do that, I think that would be a good thing.
Great. Okay, well, interesting note to end on. Absolutely. So we've been speaking with John Bradshaw. He's the foundation director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol. His new book is Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. There's a website specifically for the book, catsensebook.com, and also a Facebook page with the same thing, Cat Sense Book. So, John, thank you so much for joining us today on Talk Animals. A really interesting book and a great conversation. Thanks again.
It's a great pleasure.
All right. In just a few minutes, we'll speak with Patricia Massari about the Tampa Bay Walk for Farm Animals coming up November 2nd. Right now, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. Thought it only fitting that we do something cat-oriented. Here's part of a vintage piece from Ellen DeGeneres called Cat in Heat on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I personally like cats more than dogs. How many people, by round of applause, like cats more than dogs? Me too. How many people like dogs more than cats? Me too. I don't know. I have a cat that is in heat right now. You ever had a cat in heat? They just change on you. She was my kitten, my adorable little pet that now is a hooker. She's wearing makeup. I went into the bathroom the other night, she's putting on mascara. Tonight, won't be just any, la la, mm-hmm. She didn't know the whole song. Mm-hmm. She just just knew some of the words. She's an indoor cat, but male cats know she's in there somehow. They're just all around the house, and somehow she's sneaking out because the other morning I found a stamp on her paw. Yeah. I wouldn't have noticed. I just bought this new black light, and she passed right under it. Hey, what is that?
All right. That was Ellen DeGeneres with part of a piece called Cat in Heat, taken from her album of many years ago called Taste This. She's a coordinator of the forthcoming Tampa Bay Walk for Farm Animals. Let's welcome Patricia Massari to Talking Animals. Good morning, Patricia.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
So let's start with perhaps just a quick overview of Farm Sanctuary, which, of course, is very relevant to what we'll talk about next.
Yeah, Farm Sanctuary has been around for about 26 years. It was co-founded by Gene Bauer, and what they primarily do is a lot of vegan education as well as some welfare work in terms of bringing to light conditions for animals, especially on factory farms. Like, they were helped with the pig gestation crate ban here in Florida. And most wonderfully, they have three farms you've visited. I had the pleasure to visit this summer as well, one in New York and two in two in California, where they have rescued animals from a variety of situations like factory farms, stockyards, auctions, live markets, all sorts of situations. And these animals act as ambassadors for the visitors and for people who see them on Facebook to help people make the connection that these animals we consider farm animals or food really like our dogs and cats. So they just do a lot of really great work.
And to fund all that great work, they have various events and try to generate monies through different means. So, which brings us, I believe, to the Tampa Bay Walk for Farm Animals. What is that, and when is it, and where?
The Tampa Bay Walk for Farm Animals, this is the fifth year, and it's going to be November 2nd in Spa. We're going to start out in Spa Beach Park in St. Pete. That's a little bit southwest of the pier, it's right on the water there, and we have a 2.6-mile walk. Go around the Vinoy. It's a really beautiful walk. Some really nice waterfront views that we'll be walking around, and so we'll do the walk, and it's very dog and kid friendly. We'll have a kids table, and then when we come back, we'll have lots of free vegan food. Cafe Hay is one of our sponsors. It's going to give us some VLTs. Excited about that. And then we'll do our raffle. We're really excited that we have local music legend Ronnie Elliott to be playing.
Great.
Music.
A big Talking Animals friend and supporter and vice versa. So that's very cool.
Absolutely. And Anthony Damiato of AELA, which is Alliance for Earth, Liberty, Life, and Advocacy. He's going to be speaking. And so, yeah, we're going to eat. We're going to walk, raise some money for Farm Sanctuary, have some great vegan food, raffle, listen to music by Ronnie Elliott. So it's going to be a really good time.
Sounds cool. And Patricia, for those listening who say, oh, you know, this sounds great, but I don't know if I got the walk in me, I assume people can come and donate and participate in other ways, even if for one reason or another they're just not up for walking that day.
Absolutely. You can, where you register is walkforfarmanimals.org, and you can also be a virtual walker if you can't make it out or you're not in the immediate area. But yeah, if someone isn't up to walking, there's two other coordinators and volunteers will be hanging. There'll be some people hanging back, so you can sit back with them, take in the waterfront view, and yeah, you don't have to do the whole walk or the walk if that's not something that you're up to doing.
Sure. And again, we're not trying to talk anybody out of it, but I just want to make sure people know that it's like, if again, maybe you have a bum leg or you're just taking it easy that weekend, whatever, you should still, come out and, again, like you say, there's plenty of music and fun and Anthony speaking and all kinds of other great stuff. So for people to find out more, or maybe if they, on the other hand, do want to walk, is there a website or Facebook page that you could steer us to for people to either find out more or actually sign up?
Certainly. If you go to walkforfarmanimals.org, it'll have Find a Walk, and our walk is on 11-2, and it'll be the Tampa Bay Walk for the Farm Animals, and you just click on that, and you can register from there. Children under 18 are free, and they get a free T-shirt too, which is kind of nice.
Okay, we can't. Sorry, we can't talk about any prices or any things. Sorry, I thought we.
And then there's also the Tampa Bay Walk for Farm Animals Facebook page. And if you go there, you can see more about our sponsors, and also there'll be a link to register from there.
Cool. Yeah. And, of course, I can't help but wanting to add a little asterisk based on the location and note that by the other asterisk, we'll call it the St. Petersburg Walk for Farm Animals. So I like it. It's more broad-based that way. So
yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So, Facebook page, website, and again, as an aside, I should point out that Patricia's perhaps the hardest working woman on Facebook, always posting all kinds of cool things on behalf of animals and petitions and things that people should be aware of. So, all right, so Patricia, thanks again for joining us on Talk Animals, and they got plenty of time because it's the weekend after next that people, can gear up for the Tampa Bay Walk for Farm Animals November 2nd. So,
and thank you so much. Again, Duncan, really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye. All right. Duncan Strauss. Towards the end of the show, we'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a copy of John Bradshaw's new book, Cat Sense. We'll get to that in a few minutes here on Talking Animals. Right now, though, it's time for animal news and announcements. So, one thing, I saw Jane Velez Mitchell bumped into her on Saturday at VegFest. By the way, congrats to all the organizers of VegFest, a really cool, wonderful event. But what I had mentioned last week, and of course intended to mention again today, was that CNN is going to air Blackfish, the amazing documentary on captive orcas, focusing on Tillicum and SeaWorld, and really, really well done. We've talked about it a number of times on the show, and we've had the director, Gabriella Cowperthwaite, on the show. But anyways, it's going to air Thursday, as in tomorrow, at 9 on CNN. But Jane wanted me to be sure to also mention that this whole week, it's already started, I think, last night, but she's doing on her show at 7 p.m., I think, on HLN, the CNN sister station, all kinds of things related to animals in captivity. So she always does great, great work. So be sure to tune in for that. And again, Blackfish tomorrow night on CNN at 9 p.m. All right, coming up on Thursday, November 7th, from 6 to 10 p.m. in Hyde Park Village, the Humane Society of Tampa will host Woofstock, a far-out dog-friendly music festival to benefit our cool cats and doggy dudes and dudettes, of course. Bands featured will be Eccentric and Phase 5, and there's going to be vendors and food trucks and all kinds of cool things, pictures of pooches and more. So you can go to humanesocietytampa.org to find out more details about Woofstock. Also coming up, pet photos with Santa. I know. Santa, yikes. I haven't even brushed up against Halloween yet. But anyways, we work ahead on something like this. So the date for this Humane Society of Pinellas event, so what they do is they set you up and you bring your pets and family and get a photo keepsake with Santa. So the dates they're doing it are November 9th and 10th. And 16th and 17th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at 3040 State Road 590 in Clearwater. You can find out more about that at humanesocietyofpinellas.org. And just want to quickly mention, since we've covered this, I think almost from the beginning, the infamous Toronto Zoo elephants have finally made it out of there and arrived safely at Paws, the amazing sanctuary in Northern California, where they will have a lovely, wonderful life. So yay for them, yay for everybody who helped make that happen. It was a tough, tough, hard slog with a lot of opposition in the way, but thank God they're there, and it's an amazing place. I've been lucky enough to visit a couple times, and if I were a captive elephant, which I probably wouldn't want to be to begin with, but if I were, that's where I'd like to land. So, anyways, I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. This is a giveaway. You do not need to be a WNF member to win, and there'll be a prize. The winner will receive a copy of John Bradshaw's new book, Cat Sense. To the first person who calls in the correct title of this animal song, 813-239-9663. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals.
They took my blue suede shoes down to Oldsmobile. Got to rockin' with the rhythm, run 'em over at the hill. Put your cat clothes on, 'cause tonight we're gonna really rock it right.
All right, if you can guess that sort of relevant animal tune, We'll take that probably off the air because we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I'll be back next Wednesday, October 30th, with another edition. I hope you'll join me for that. So I hope you'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives, podcasts, and past Talking Animals programs, and more. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Like us on Facebook, will you? The show and or me personally. Come on. Follow us on Twitter. It's all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. We're closing out today's show with an animal song, sort of a further remembrance of the late, great Cat Smokey, who heard this artist a lot and intended as a bit of a healing musical tonic to Liz. This is Earl Bostick with Flamingo on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. Thanks for listening. Speak with you again next Wednesday at 9 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.